Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. And today we actually have a very special episode because we are interviewing one of our own, Dr. Jose Marcelino, a postdoctoral scientist here at the University of Florida Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory. He and Dr. Ellis have published a paper called The Movement of Western Honeybees Among U.S. States and Territories, some of the histories, benefits, risk, and mitigation strategies. And so what we're going to do is a little bit different than what we normally do in a podcast, but Jamie will also kind of pitch in with some of his feedback. And so, Jamie, the first question I have is for you. Can you tell us a little bit of background that led to the formation of this effort?
Yeah, so Amy, I can. It's going to be a couple minute spiel. So hopefully you listeners
That's
out there,
fine.
You can just kind of bear with me. Okay. All right. First, I'm going to talk about the title, The Movement of Western Honeybees Among U.S. States and Territories. When people think about honeybees moving around, they almost always use the term import or export. But those terms are specifically about bringing honeybees into a country from another country or moving them to another country from your country. We're not talking about imports and exports with this effort. We're talking about movement, and we define movement of honeybee colonies as moving colonies within a country. So this is important. Why would this even come up in the first place? I'm going to make a long story short. A few years ago, I was contacted by a colleague at USDA APHIS right about the time when there was discussion of potentially moving some colonies or queens of honeybees from Puerto Rico to the U.S. mainland. And so it is the federal government's policy that movement within the United States is not restricted, right? Their policy is essentially once honeybees are in the U.S., they can be moved anywhere within the U.S. But of course, we're the United States of America, which means all the states get to set their own policies related to a lot of different things, but also including movement. So while the federal government may be okay with bees moving, say, from Puerto Rico to, just to use a specific example here, to Florida, the state government of Florida may not be okay with that, depending on the bee that's being proposed to be moved, et cetera. And so Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, all of these places are the United States. They're all part of the United States, even if they don't have official statehood. So the idea is while the federal government says we can move or there's no regulations against moving bees between these areas, the question arose from my APHIS colleague, should this be something that we do? And I think most of our listeners out there wouldn't struggle with the idea of moving honeybees from Florida to Georgia or from Georgia to California, from California to New York. None of these are things that kind of raise concern for beekeepers. We do it all the time. There's a pretty homogenized disease and pest population across North America, the continental, the 48 contiguous states, as it were. But it does raise an important question. If, say, a particular virus isn't present in the honeybee population in Guam, should we be moving bees from California with this virus to Guam or vice versa? So this kind of produced an effort where a lot of scientists came together with federal and state officials to form a technical working group to look at this issue. You know, what's the history, the benefits, risk, and mitigation strategies associated with moving honeybees between the continental 48 states and the outlying states and territories? And this is kind of where our lab was tasked with leading this technical working group. we were funded to do that. And we published this paper specifically where we review this issue. You know, what's the history of moving bees within the U.S.? What's the benefits of moving bees within the U.S.? There are risks of moving bees within the U.S. What are those? And how can those risks be mitigated? So kind of enter into this discussion, Dr. Marcelino, who is a postdoctoral scientist who joined the lab a couple of years ago. And he was the one in our lab tasked with doing the everyday work associated with this idea, you know, the movement of honeybees within the U.S. And so our first phase, we produced this manuscript that we've published as open access. We'll link it. I know there's a lot of folks who listen to our podcast from around the world, but you're going to have this same issue as well. If you've got outlying states or provinces or territories that have honeybees, the question is going to arise, should we move them? And under what framework should we share honeybees? And Amy, I'll let you take it away from here, with Jose, who's really become an expert on this topic since he led the literature review associated with publishing this manuscript.
Right. So Jose, you know, we've had you with the lab here now for a couple of years, and I know a lot about you. I think the one thing I do know about you is that you love banana bread. Other than that is very true. Other than that, can you tell us a little bit, introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Thank you, Amy, and thank you everybody that is listening. Thank you for having me here. So my background is a little diverse. I am from Europe, from Portugal, and I first started to do forest engineering, and then I discovered insects, and I loved insects, and I started to work on their biology, behavior, and then I funneled in from other organisms to honeybees because of their importance and of their intriguing behavior and biology. And so after multiple steps, I reached the US and I did my PhD in Vermont, and then I went to Illinois and then to Puerto Rico and then ultimately to the University of Florida, where I am today.
So Jose, you know, we've been fortunate to have you here. And one of the projects that you've managed for us here in the laboratory is the day-to-day work associated with this technical working group, looking at what you and I consider this very important topic. You know, just because we can move bees between the contiguous 48 states and the outlying territories, should we? And so you really did the initial literature review for that manuscript that we're talking about, that many scientists from across the country, as well as colleagues of ours from USDA helped put together. So just to focus in on that effort, can you tell us a little bit about the history of honeybee movement within the U.S.? And we're going to start from when it wasn't movement, from when it was actually an importation. When were honeybees imported into the U.S.? And after that, could you talk a little bit about, you know, current regulations associated with movement within the U.S.?
Yes. So that's a very interesting question. And it is very interesting to try to navigate all the information that it's available. So what we know and we can accurately assess, it's what's documented. So we have documentation from mostly the advent of steamship in the US. So there was a lot of activity from the initial of the 17th century to the early 20th century. There was a lot of import activity to the US. But prior to that, you know, during the exploration of the America, most certainly beehives were brought, but we don't have documentation regarding that. So the one we have is from the 17th century onwards. So what we know is that there were a lot of imports from Europe, and some subspecies that were of interest because it was known in, let's say, Italy or other Northern Europe that they were highly productive. And mainly that was the main criteria to try to bring them, was that they would produce a lot of honey. And so multiple subspecies were introduced at that time, namely the Italian bee, Ligustica, which is a very still preferred to this day, Carnica mellifera from Europe, Caucasica from Middle East, and Iberiensis from the Iberian Peninsula at the western point of Europe. But there were other origins, for instance, from Egypt, Syria, Cyprus, Northern Africa. There's also documentation about this. So there's already the ones I said, it's a panel of 7 to 8 that are very well documented. However, all of this stopped when the Federal Honeybee Act banned importation of the honeybee, because they were starting to have concerns about, you know, we don't know what is being brought, and it might bring pathogens or other sources of negative traits. So in the 1920s, with the Federal Honeybee Act, this stopped. However, after this, and through time, there were amendments to the act that would allow importation with some premises, you know, that the bees were monitored for their health. And if they were healthy, and healthy, it's a broad statement, but if they were considered healthy, they could be brought in. So currently, there are a lot of variability in what can be done. So like Jamie was saying, and now I'm going to speak, well, for imports, there's a lot of considerations, and basically you have to screen them and have certificates, et cetera, that they are healthy. However, if they are subspecies of concern, and these are what is called African bees, and in the US they are called Africanized, but African bees that are Apis scutellata or Apis capensis or Apis serrana, these in particular are regulated at federal state. So they cannot be imported, and they cannot be moved within the US. However, like I was saying, there are this is at federal level, but like Jamie said, at state level, the states can also regulate what happens. And this is what's happening, and that's what we documented in this paper. So we went over and we contacted a lot of APR inspectors of all the states and territories to know what was the regulation, because even sometimes it's very difficult to navigate the printed or online regulations and legislations per state. It's kind of a rabbit hole to find and pinpoint what it's the information. So we compiled everything in a table and in an interactive map so people could access it easily. And what we found is that there's a big discrepancy. So some states do not regulate at all. So you can freely move things in and out. And some other states have a lot of regulations. However, I would like to point out that when I say no regulations, it's a very strict number of states, like 3 or 4, because most of them, even if they say we do not regulate, they still have to pass through a process of you know, certifying that the bees are healthy. So the concern that they are healthy, it's also broad, but it might mean just that they don't have pests and pathogens, and that the subspecies or the race that is moved is not relevant. Whereas for other states, what is being moved apart from the health status, it's critical. Meaning this criteria that the federal regulation stated, mean the African or Africanized bee, or the Asian bee, Apis serrana, which is not in the US, or Apis capensis, cannot be introduced or moved, etc. And this translates into a grid that is not, you know, standardized, and ultimately things can be moved quite freely.
So Jose, can you tell us why the movement within the U.S. started? And then also, can you describe some of the benefits of moving honeybees among states and territories?
Yeah, so honeybees are very intricate with humans for, you know, many, many centuries. So with the advent of the large-scale agricultural industry, the need for pollinators and the need to have pollination services from honeybees was very evident. And this triggered migratory beekeeping, which is very, very well established, as we all know, in the US, starting with the migration to the migratory human-mediated migration of hives to the West Coast for California beekeeping, and then to other states to provide pollination services. And you have to remember that this is very intricate in the not only in the US, but in Europe and in other states, in other countries, sorry. So in the United States, the beekeeping has several levels of importance for the US economy, for instance, because the pollination services to the crop industry in the US, it's estimated in 12 to 50 billions a year, billions with a B. And, you know, there's, so this is at the whole economy. And then at the beekeeper level, you know, there's 1.8 million colonies being moved across the US. So this is 60 to 75% of the all commercial colonies. And this translates into at the commercial beekeepers level into revenues for you know, rental fees. And, you know, the crops are strongly dependent on the bees. You know, most 70% of all the crops in the that are produced in the US and across the world rely exclusively on in pollination services and mostly honeybees. So the benefits are very intricate with the society and to provide food security, which is a term used across the world to relate honeybees with human society. So they are very intricate in the food security for human societies. There is also ecological value, you know, non-marketable ecosystem services. You know, bees are also responsible in part for ecosystem function and stability. So, you know, the network of pollination between pollinators and plants is highly dependent on honeybees. So there's also, like I said, ecological value. And there's also other benefits for movement. For instance, stock improvement, which is one of the main reasons apart for the pollination services. So stock improvement is really important to increase productivity and increase resistance to pathogens or pests. So that is also very critical. And lastly, to replace colony loss. As you know, winter colony loss are quite high on the 40s percentage. So beekeepers mitigate these losses by purchasing colonies or moving hives of their preferred stocks. So in all of this translates into a lot of dependence from beekeeping at national and international worldwide level for human societies.
Jose, that's a really good summary of the benefits of moving honeybees among states and territories. But as you know, it's a very tricky issue, right? So again, rephrasing this idea that within the U.S., there's no really federal regulation against moving honeybees once they're in the U.S., but it's super state dependent, depending on, you know, what state policies are. And of course, beekeepers want to be able to do it. Certainly within the contiguous 48 states, they're moving bees all over the place for honey production, pollination purposes, stock improvement, and all the benefits that you just note. But Jose, there are some risks associated with moving honeybees. And again, I'm not, you know, this paper isn't really aimed at addressing those risks within the contiguous 48. It's more about moving bees from the 48 to outlying states and territories and vice versa. So could you give us a brief overview of some of those risks associated with moving honeybees?
Yes. Well, the most known and the most talked about risk about moving bees between states and territories is the dissemination of pests and pathogens. You know, some of them are quite evident, like varroa, but there are other things that are, you know, you don't see and you might be moving. So that's one of the main concerns. And in fact, in the paper, we have a case study about varroa and why the spread of varroa was so quick in the late 80s, because there was a lack of a central or common authority governing movement. So these concerns about movement can be traced back to the 80s, and we document some of these issues of dissemination of pathogens because of a lack of a standardized or centralized or a common authority governing movement. So yeah, the most critical one and the most spoke about is the dissemination of honeybees pests and pathogens. However, the spread of resistant genes, for instance, you know, you can move a certain stock that can spread resistance or spread pathogens that have resistance to, let's say, a pesticide. And also there can be the spread of deleterious genes in the honeybees, meaning an introduction of a bee that is susceptible to a particular organism, whereas the resident bees were not. So this is also a problem and a documented problem. And also the dissemination or the loss of traits when you move honeybees. For instance, you can move honeybees that are of interest because they have a particular trait. But if that trait is not genetically, how can I say it? Genetically established in the population, you might lose that trait when you move the bees over a couple generations. So, and also you can, conversely, you can disseminate a trait to other bees by admixture. You know, admixture in honeybees is central, you know, crossing races or even subspecies. So you can be disseminating something you do not wish to be disseminated, and that can have impact in productivity or health of your honeybees. And also a very important one is the impact on other flora or fauna. And this is a major concern for some groups in the US, which is, you know, you might be moving, you might want to be to move bees for an area that is pristine or it's conserved or it has a, is known to have a high biodiversity of other pollinators. So there might be concerns that moving the bees could have impacts on the established population of other pollinators or other bees. So all of these concerns are in state, but the most relevant one and is the dissemination of pests on pathogens. However, the US covers this or is aware of this and tries to mitigate this problem by doing national health surveys that are done across all the states and territories to know what is the status of the population of pests and pathogens. So all of this can be and is taken into consideration when something is being moved.
Okay, so Jose, you just described some of the risks associated with moving honeybees. And, you know, Jamie, I know that you and I have discussed some of the strategies for movement, so mitigation strategies for risk. So do you want to kind of go into what these are?
So that's a very important question, Amy. And one of the things that I want to make sure our listeners hear clearly is that this group of individuals, this technical working group who are coming together, they're not proposing at all to stop movement the way it is currently happening, right? The movement of honeybees to pollinate almonds in California, the movement of honeybees to pollinate blueberries in Maine, things like that. But we do recognize that the movement of honeybees between the 48 contiguous states and the outlying states and territories share a lot of similarities with import exports, maybe even more so than the standard just movement, right? Where you're moving around within a country. So as a result, there are risks associated with moving bees from the contiguous 48 to Guam and vice versa, or to Puerto Rico and vice versa, or the US Virgin Islands and vice versa. So as a technical working group, we're not here trying to set policy or shape policy or say that this shouldn't be done. We're just saying, hey, when you move bees in this way, there are these risks. Obviously, we might need to be able to do it because there's all these benefits associated with moving bees, but there's also these risks. And anytime, Amy, you do a risk assessment, when you're considering whether or not to do something, and in this case, move bees between the contiguous 48 and an outlying state territory or vice versa, you don't want to just say it shouldn't be done. You want to categorize that level of risk. You want to say, here's the risk that this threat, this movement poses. Now, should we mitigate that? Are there ways that that risk can be mitigated and therefore permit the move? So for example, you might say moving bees between Florida and the U.S. Virgin Islands under this specific scenario is simply too risky. You shouldn't do it. Or you might say, you know what, there are some risks associated with moving bees between Florida and the U.S. Virgin Islands, but we know what they are. And here are the mitigation strategies that, if followed, then would endorse the proposed move. So we didn't as a group want to just say movement shouldn't happen. We wanted to say clearly, here's some of the risk associated with movement, but here are mitigation strategies that, when followed for moderate or low risk movements, could really reduce the risk to a much more tolerable level. And so Jose spent a lot of time looking at those mitigation strategies, of course, along with the team of individuals who are members of this technical working group. So Jose, what were some of the risk mitigation strategies that we were able to share in the manuscript?
So like you were saying, most of the mitigation strategies we analyzed are based on importation and what was done in the past for imports, namely for the Russian honeybees. But there are also protocols in place in the US, and we also analyzed them, namely the movement of the hilo bee from Hawaii and to Hawaii. I think this is relevant because when we say and we analyze all this, we are not saying that the movement has to completely be changed or the strategies that are in place have to be changed. No, even if movement sometimes is not regulated, there is also some kind in the legislation, there is also some kind of screening before things are moved, with very few exceptions, 3 or 4 exceptions. So see, the government and the states, it's aware of some of these risks that we just described and some of the benefits, and they do have, to a minor or a bigger extent, some kind of monitoring before a movement happens. However, it's not standardized. And what we are advocating for is to provide suggestions as to how standardized and to how mitigate movement. And in this case, for mitigation, we saw some of the protocols that were done for importation could also be used for movement, but you know, movement here is movement of specific races or subspecies that are in the U.S. already and have been documented, and this is important, have been substantially studied for traits of interest and health stability and strong health characteristics. So as you know, the Russian bee was introduced and it was quarantined. And an important thing is that germplasm was introduced. It was not that the actual bees are introduced. So this is a good way to prevent some of the most known pathogens to be introduced or pests if you just are moving germplasm and then artificially inseminate bees at the locally. So this is something that we think is a good strategy. The instrumental insemination of germplasm into existing honeybee populations instead of moving the actual bees, because there's always a level of uncertainty with a live organism, how it will behave. Even if you studied for years, you don't know 100% what will happen when you move them from point A or from region A to region B. And this is done for the Hilo bee. Although federal movement of the bees to Hawaii is not permitted, there are USDA established programs that allow for germplasm to go there and to, you know, germplasm of varroa resistant reared in quarantine facilities at USDA facilities. So, you know, in a closed environment, so they are not open air apiaries, and they are moved to Hawaii. So in controlled conditions, the germplasm is moved there. So to enhance the resistance to varroa of the Hawaiian bees. So this is an example of what is done within the US for movement and what are the mitigation strategies they do when this movement occurs. And actually at this point, the movement back to the US from these Hilo bees has been progressively been expanded from initially was, you know, just a few queens, and in 2020 was expanded to thousands of queens. But again, all of this is continuously monitored. So this is another thing that introductions have to be monitored after they happen. So after quarantine and distribution commercially, they have to be monitored. These are some aspects that are critical for a cohesive mitigation strategy when movement occurs, and also a stock certification program that can include multiple risk strategies should be implemented. I mean, there are attempts to have a standardized certification program across the US, but it's not still, you know, the criteria to establish this are still not well defined or implemented across all the states and territories. Namely, what are the attributes of stocks that are relevant commercially? So this needs to be defined, and, you know, what are the screening that has to be done. I mean, you can do superficial screening, just visual screening, and then you can do in-depth genomics screening for pests and pathogens, namely for viruses. And, you know, there are things you cannot do by visual observation. But, you know, a composition of all this criteria could lead to the implementation of a stock certification program that would support robust movement, meaning that you can actually accurately know what you are moving by reducing substantially or almost completely the chance of risk of plant dissemination of pathogens or pests or other risks that we defined previously, and also not to move bees for regions where they are not present. For instance, these pristine areas that I was defining before, or, you know, forests that are kept pristine for whatever ecological reasoning, and they do not have honeybees, they should not go there unless, you know, again, thoroughly the impacts are studied. And I think that's a key, that a lot of research has to be done prior to suggesting or accepting moving from point A to point B.
So Jose, I think you really provided a good summary of kind of the highlights in the manuscript and the efforts of the technical working group. So what's next? What's the future of this issue? What's the technical working group going to do now that they've got this first manuscript out?
Yes, that's a good question. So after, you know, I'm not sure if we define this group, but the technical working group is composed of many academics, but also the USDA agencies. So we try to compile or to group the best knowledge that is available within the US and abroad to help us to provide an overview of what is the current status of the industry and the regulations, which is what we are discussing now. And now in a second phase, what we are going to, or we are going to do with this technical working group, is to provide a potential method to decide on a movement or decide on not to move a particular stock or a particular race or a particular honeybee with interest. So what we are doing as a group now is to generate a support decision tool that can help decision-making agencies or other decision-making stockholders or others that are in the process of deciding these movements. So what should be a stepwise decision process based on the risks, on the benefits, and on what is moved? What should be the strategy to be sure that all the parameters that are necessary to be covered, that we just discussed, the benefits, risks, etc., if they are all contemplated, and, you know, basically decide to progress in a decision tool, a dichotomous decision tool, so a yes or a no. For instance, we aim to define what is being moved and then provide a risk assessment based on all the criteria that we just defined. And then based on proficient knowledge of the people that are part of this technical working group, suggest decisions that can be made based on this analysis of risks and benefits and advantages, issues that might occur with moving a particular bee from point A to point B. But again, like for this first paper, we are not advocating that everything has to be, every single time you move a single bee, you have to go through a procedure. It's mostly for bees that have traits of interest or traits of concern. So how to balance this and make it informed decision on movement or not. I mean, of course, we are not intending to regulate movement established for pollination services that are critical and imperative to happen and are well established in the US. So yeah, we are trying to define a supportive tool that can better inform decision making agencies or stockholders on move or not move a particular bee to their territories.
All right, Jose, thank you so much for coming on to our podcast today. I'm excited to share this publication with our listeners, and hopefully they'll be able to take a chance to read through the article and you know, see what you've compiled, you and this great group compiling this information together. So thank you so much again for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy, and everybody that is listening. Again, we do provide the tool for a quick visualization of what are the regulations in an interactive map. And I would encourage people to try to use that link if they want to know or to further explore what are the limitations or what are the non-restricted movement that can be done in the US states and territories. And I think this is a valuable tool that many EPR inspectors were grateful when we were compiling it. So I think people might want to see that in particular.
Absolutely.
Thank you all.
All right, thank you. So everyone, that was Dr. Jose Marcelino, a postdoctoral scientist here at the University of Florida Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Two Bees in a Podcast. I thought that was really cool. And I've taken a look at the publication, The Movement of Western Honeybees Among U.S. States and Territories. And I think it's just really great that Jose was able to take everything, kind of bring it together into, you know, one publication to discuss the history, the benefits, the risk, and some mitigation strategies, because I don't think that I'm not even sure, has this been done before?
So, Amy, it's not been done from a movement perspective. It's almost always done from an import-export perspective. So, for example, the federal government here in the U.S. has rules, regulations about importing or exporting bees into or out of the United States. And many countries around the world have that issue. But, you know, there are a lot of countries are more than just a single landmass. Of course, the United States is one of those. But we have the 48 contiguous states, but we also have Alaska and Hawaii, and then various territories like we've been talking about, Puerto Rico, Guam, all those things. So most folks think about honeybees being transported strictly from that import-export. Right. But this is more of that movement perspective where, you know, when you're taking bees from some of these outlying states' territories to the contiguous 48 and vice versa, and you could say the same thing like British colonies or French colonies, et cetera. It's a lot more like an import-export scenario than it is just simply a movement scenario. And so while a lot of governments have looked at it from that import-export perspective, we're just not aware of a lot that have looked at it from within our own country. What about these unique scenarios that pop up? Should we be moving bees under these scenarios?
Yeah. And I think it's really cool that, you know, Jose and the whole group actually was able to compile this and make it a resource for policymakers. You know, this could make change, you know, this could create change and change behavior in what is allowed and not allowed, you know, just within among our states, but also, as you mentioned, some of the territories that are outside.
Yeah. So, Amy, this is a really good place to pause and just kind of insert something. You know, because this can really freak out a lot of people. What, you're proposing that we stop moving bees? We need to move bees to California, or we need to move bees wherever. It's like, that's not at all what we are trying to do. We are just trying to look at it from a scientific kind of a research perspective, specifically in these scenarios where we're talking about moving bees between a landmass and its outlying states' territories. So this the first manuscript we produced is exactly that, a resource for folks who are considering what to do under these scenarios. And, you know, there is a phase two of this effort. And I want to stress in this phase two of this effort that we are actually trying to develop a risk assessment protocol so that if policymakers or resource or rule and regulation makers someday want to say, hey, we need to consider movement under these unique scenarios more like import exports than we do just moving bees, what are some guidelines we could use? We want to provide that resource in the form of a risk assessment. In other words, just like Jose was talking about, you walk down this yes, no tree. Is the bee this or that? Yes, no. Is the bee this? Yes, no. Is the bee that? Yes, no. And it be assigned a risk score. And that score essentially will dictate, well, if it's assigned a score of this, these mitigation strategies will help you overcome this. Or, hey, you know, this is simply too risky. The risk outweighs the benefit of moving bees between this spot and this spot, and we shouldn't do it. And we just want that to be a resource for those folks who are having to consider these policies now as this world is increasingly globalized and it's so much easier to move bees than it ever has been before. So yeah, we feel it's an important issue, and we're trying to provide that resource to these policymakers before they have to face a scenario where a movement is imminent, right, and something needs to be done.
It's everybody's favorite game show, Stump the Chump.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the question and answer segment. So, Jamie, we are recording in October of 2022. We just had a pretty bad hurricane come through. Hurricane Ian came through, and it basically came through, well, you know, besides the devastating impacts it had on honeybee colonies and the flooding that it caused, it also affected the pollen and nectar sources, all the forage that we have for the honeybees. And so we had a questioner email us asking about flowers and sugar water and what we need to do with the bees. And so really generally speaking, you know, what do beekeepers need to do when they don't have forage post-hurricane? Because they don't want their colonies to starve, but they also don't want to really grow their colonies at this time either. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so there's a lot of what ifs that I'm going to provide kind of in my answer to this question. And it's very important, Amy, that you did what you did, which is set the stage. You know, here in Florida, the hurricane came through kind of early October, which is when we're feeling the effects, the aftermath of this hurricane. And for us, we're discussing this at a time of the year where we're a few weeks into fall, formally fall. But in Florida, there's still a lot of floral resources, especially in southern Florida where the hurricane went through. So there were a lot of beekeepers who were allowing their colonies to grow, or at least to store food based on the amount of nectar and pollen that was coming in from the environment. So when that tap is shut off, when there's no more of the floral resources available, what do you need to do to ensure colonies have enough feed, but you're not overfeeding to cause them to grow? Well, the short answer to that question is you would do what most of the beekeepers in the rest of the country have to do. You know, Florida, we're fortunate in that we have a really strong, significant fall flow, especially in southern Florida. A lot of other beekeepers do as well. But there are a lot of beekeepers who don't have that fall flow. And what they'll do is they usually feed their colonies just to ensure that there's something around a medium super's worth of honey on, because that's about the amount of honey that's going to take to help the colony through winter. So it's not like you're saying, well, if I feed too much, they're going to grow. You don't have to worry so much about that. You're kind of feeding them to a target fullness, and then you're stopping. And my usual target fullness is about a medium super's worth of honey. That's about, you know, half to two-thirds of a deep box worth of honey. And if you use shallows, that's about a shallow and a half worth of honey. So you're feeding until you get to that point. Now, it is important to note that the hurricane floral damage is not permanent. Now, and I'm going to discuss something now from a sample size of one. We actually had a hurricane go through the Florida Panhandle a few years ago, and it came through roughly the same time of year and really took out a lot of the fall forage. And so there was that immediate need for bees to be fed if they didn't have enough resources. But some beekeeper colleagues of mine from the Panhandle said about 3 weeks later is when a lot of the wildflowers restarted blooming and forage became available. So the reason I'm bringing that up in this particular case is entirely possible that in 3 to 4 weeks, some of these flowers that you would have been relying on ordinarily will come back. It depends on how late in the season the hurricane comes. You know, if it turns cool as well, you know, none of those things may come back at the end anyway. So I don't really base it based on what's coming in from the environment, but more what I know bees need to survive winter. And it's that time of year to get bees ready for that purpose anyway. So I would feed to the point that I have, you know, roughly that medium super's worth of honey, and then I stop feeding.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair. So on that same note, you know, with hurricanes or storms in general, it leads me to the second question that I have for this Q&A segment. And that is, you know, how do you get ready? How do you get colonies ready for hurricanes?
So this is a difficult question to answer, because if, for those of you listening around the world, here in the U.S., I'm sure it's true elsewhere, we score hurricanes at five categories. And, you know, what you would have to do for your colonies to survive the different categories is quite different. And frankly, once you're getting to category four and five storms, it's there's just really very little that you can do for colonies. If the storm's coming through at that strength, there's just little preparation work you can do. So let me just kind of back up and talk about general things that could be done to help avoid problems, knowing that sometimes, just even in the best case scenarios, it's completely out of our hands. So the big threats in hurricane are wind damage, so blowing colonies over, blowing hives apart, right? Water damage, usually in the form of flooding of some sort, or the damage associated with the two of those own something else. For example, strong winds and lots of rains can push trees over, and trees may fall onto your hives. And so really, wind and water can contribute to lots of problems. So I will tell you folks out there how we prepare colonies or hives when significant storms, in our case, hurricanes, but for that matter, any other significant wind or rain event, are coming our way. So what we try to do is we try to stabilize the hives. In our case, we keep two hives on a single stand. And so what we will normally do is slide those two hives together immediately side by side. Their walls are touching. And we will run a ratchet strap around the top, down the sides, around the bottom, and up the other side of the hives. And basically, we're ratcheting them from top to bottom to make it less likely that they will just fall apart or that a lid will fly off. I personally like to stabilize the hives. If they're sitting on a stand, right, they could blow off of the stand or things like that. A lot of folks will move their hives to the ground to stabilize them a bit, but that can be a problem if you get 2, 3, 4, 12, 15 inches of rain. So what I have done in the past is I will drive a metal post down beside either side of a hive. And so not only do I have a ratchet strap that kind of goes around the top and the bottom of the hive, but I will go with a ratchet strap around the front and back of the hive, around those metal posts that I have driven in the ground around it. So that way the hive is kind of anchored, you know, front and back, top and bottom, so that it's less likely to tilt forward or fall off its stand or be blown apart or things like that. Now, a lot of commercial beekeepers keep their hives on pallets. You know, you'll have 4 to 6 colonies on the pallet, and it's just really difficult to go and strap 100 or 200 or 1,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 hives. But for hobbyists, strapping them and anchoring them to the ground or to stand in some way is a really good idea. So that's number one. Number two, never keep bees in low-lying areas. It's really hard to know when a big storm is coming and you've got a lot of hives that you have to go move them all to higher ground. Mm-hmm. So the better angle, Amy, is rather than responding to a storm coming, is just to keep a habit of always staying high and dry. Just right. Never put bees in a place that can flood. And I'm talking, you know, even the 100-year flood where an unusual amount of rain would cause that to happen. You just really want to be high and dry with bees so they can be up and out of water. And I know that's easier said than done. And it's very tricky to do, especially in some areas like in southern Florida, where it just floods a lot all over the place. But to the best of one's ability, you want to keep them out of any area that has any remote possibility of flooding. And then third, I like to keep hives away from trees. I don't like to put them under trees, under tree limbs or tree branches, just in case things fall down on them. A lot of people, especially hobbyists, might put their hives beside a structure, beside a shed or a house or some building in the back. And that can be a good idea. But if 4 or 5 category storms are coming through, then it's going to, you know, there's just again, little you can do. Another thing that we do is we take off any feeder jars or anything that's on the outside of the hive that might blow away. So we want to make sure that they are strapped, that they're tight, they're anchored to the ground, they're out of low-lying areas, and they're away from places where things can fall on them. Apart from that, there's not a whole lot else that you can do. It's just, it's really painful to see when these big storms go through and to know what the beekeepers are going through. But at least in some of those lower category storms, following those basic tips can help more often than not.
So there was one other thing that I wanted to mention, and I wanted to kind of hear your thoughts on it. You know, sometimes when the lids are propolized shut, you know, and there's flooding, at that point, the bees really only have one, you know, entrance and exit, right? And so is it recommended to have like a little opening so that the bees can come in and out? Because I mean, you've kind of gotten to the point where it's raining, and so you don't want them to, you know, you don't want them to flood that way. But also, you know, if the water is coming through the entrance, what are your thoughts on just having a little like hole or leaving a tiny hole as far as where the, if you have like a top feeder on top?
Yeah, it's such a hard thing to talk about.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked a lot in our insulation interviews with experts who talk about hive configuration insulation. They talk about no upper entrances. You don't want that airflow through a hive,
right?
You know, because colonies aren't choosing those types of cavities in the wild, right? They're usually choosing cavities with single entrances at the bottom, things like that. But I would argue, and certainly based on what we saw with Hurricane Ian, it's really good when hurricanes or big storms are coming and floods that are anticipated to have some sort of upper entrance, because kind of like what you're hinting at, a lot of beekeepers who had their colonies in Southern Florida during this particular storm, when the floodwaters came through, they were high enough to fill like the lower brood box, maybe even the second box with water, but there might've been a third or a fourth box that the bees were able to move into, but because there's no other openings or gaps in the hive, they suffocated, or when the water rose too high, they were unable to get away and they drowned. So that's certainly leaves open the need or the benefit of that case of an upper entrance of any type that the bees could have gotten through. So I would say if you're in a low-lying area and you can't get out, providing that upper entrance in advance of the storm is a really useful thing to consider.
All right. So for our third question today, this person was asking about, another person and what they did in their colony. But this individual regularly checks the solar activity forecast before opening her hives. So she says that the bees are more agitated on days with higher solar activity. So are there any studies to confirm this? And is this, you know, is this something that beekeepers should be looking at before they go into their colonies?
So, Amy, I had to do a little bit of background research in anticipation of this question. I saw this question coming in. I didn't really see any research related to this. The only project that I saw was someone in the 1980s that actually looked at how solar radiation affects flight activity. And even that was, you know, not overwhelmingly significant. It was like what you would expect, higher levels of solar radiation. You get a little bit more bee flight. So I would argue that this person is probably just doing something that they've kind of found based on a anecdotal observation. And I would say I've worked bees under inclement weather and weather conditions of all type, and I've really not noticed a pattern with sun intensity or solar radiation intensity in bee behavior. That doesn't mean it's not there. It just means that I've never really worked bees around it one way or another and haven't noticed that there's something happening. So I would say it's one of those things that remains up in the air, but I wouldn't plan my beekeeping activities around it, honestly.
Right. Sounds good. All right. Well, beekeepers, if you have questions, I've been loving the fact that beekeepers have just been emailing us with questions, with comments. Some beekeepers, Jamie, have been recommending certain guests, and I love that. So beekeepers, if you have a guest, a scientist, an educator, a beekeeper who is doing something interesting, you know, send their information our way, and we can take a look at having them as a guest on our podcast.
Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. For more information and resources on today's episode, check out the Honeybee Research Lab website at ufhoneybee.com. If you have questions you want answered on air, email them to us at honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on social media at UF Honeybee Lab on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. This episode was hosted by Jamie Ellis and Amy Vu. This podcast is produced and edited by Amy Vu and Sarah Sowers. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.